This is Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley. It's a podcast about making things up and making things happen. I love talking to creative people like authors. And today is part two of my conversation with Abney Nazemian. He's a writer that I met a few months back at a party. We hit it off right away because he had a Madonna t-shirt on. Last week, we talked about his book, Like a Love Story, which is set in the 80s. And Madonna is a big part of that book. We also talked about the concert, which I had just seen. So that was all sort of Madonna land. But this part two, he has a newer book out called Only This Beautiful Moment. It recently won the Stonewall Award for Young Adult Literature. And it's a wonderful story about three generations of one family. There are gay characters in it. Part of it is set in Iran. It's really interesting and really beautiful. And another thing that we talk about in this part two is Abney's books have been banned in the last year or so, particularly Like a Love Story. So I talked to him about what it's like to be one of those authors that you hear about in the news. And it's interesting and a little bit heartbreaking. But before we get to the interview, I want to remind you that this podcast, Dennis Anyone, is brought to you by me, Dennis Hensley. I do it. I love it. It brings me a lot of joy. I find it very meaningful. The more it goes along, the more I love it. But you can support it if you like it in two ways. You can go to DennisAnyone.net and you can leave a tip in my virtual tip jar. It helps me cover my expenses and keep the thing going. And another thing you can do is become a subscriber to DNR Studios. I'm part of a group of shows under the Derek and Romaine banner. And for a monthly subscription, you get my show early and you get all these other great, fun LGBTQ shows. That's at DNRstudios.com. I also want to mention that coming up in April, it's the 10th anniversary of Dennis Anyone. So I might play some voice messages if I get any. So if you want to leave a message, like, I don't know, congratulations on 10 years, or share any thoughts about any episode you remember. Or I'm also trying to figure out what to do with my life. So if you have any ideas about what Dennis should do with his life, you can leave them on 1-888-647-9653. 1-888-647-9653. And we'll see what happens. All right. That's enough for the plugs and the business. Here now is my interview, part two, with Abney Nazemian. How do you find out you've been banned? What happens?
Oftentimes I get like, I now have set a Google alert because it happens often. You'll get like a link with like what books are being challenged or banned. Sometimes you'll get DMs from librarians or teachers who are devastated to send you the news, just letting you know that your book's been taken off shelves in their district. A lot of banning happens district to district. And I think as with many issues we care about so much in our country, whether it's book banning or queer rights or reproductive freedom, a lot of it is happening locally. So it's a good reminder to listeners to also get involved locally and vote locally.
Did I see somewhere online that RuPaul's doing a ban for banned books? Did you see this?
Oh yeah, I did. Yes. I did not know RuPaul was involved. An amazing guy named Eric Cervini and his partner, Adam Powell, started that. And they had reached out to me because, of course, Like a Love Story has been so massively banned, to make sure that my books were on the bus. So these two books, Like a Love Story and Only This Beautiful Moment, are stocked on the bus. And I think they have enough copies to give out all over. It's amazing what they're doing.
I saw a report on 60 Minutes this past weekend. You may have seen it, about book bans.
I did not. I have been banned and I've been so immersed in it.
Talk to me about that. Like, how does it work?
So here's the biggest misconception. The biggest misconception is that it's somehow a good thing for authors.
It's publicity. And no, there's no bad publicity, kind of.
There's no bad publicity. The truth is that within the category of young adult, a lot of sales come from schools and libraries. And when it's banned from a district, that means schools and libraries are not going to approve it. So a lot of your sales are gone. A lot of the money to authors also comes from visiting those schools. So it means that you're getting booked a lot less. So they've kind of, I think a lot of the banning is actually intimidation. It's trying to stop school districts from welcoming these books into their curriculum because they know what's happening. I mean, what's happening is classrooms are reading books like a Love Story. I've visited so many schools that are using this book as a way to teach queer history, teach ACT UP. I've talked to many. Yesterday I had a Zoom with students in a New York City school. I've spoken to much more, you know, red type states. Even in New York City, one of the teenagers said they've barely been taught anything about HIV in their school. I mean, it's very shocking when you think of what a huge not just in terms of history, what a huge part of our modern history it is that they should know, but it still affects them. They're not being taught proper sexual education still. So, you know, I think people are scared and there's a lot of intimidation. Then the other piece of it for authors is that if you're not smart enough to avoid the online stuff, which I now do, but I didn't in the beginning. In the beginning, when I was getting banned and people were attacking the book and then attacking me personally, because in their opinion, the fact that I wrote this book makes me a groomer, pornographer, you know, all those words that they love to throw around. They kind of personally attack you online. And I made the mistake of engaging with it and trying to defend myself often with humor. And, you know, I'm like, well, I can't let people say this about me. And then it eats away at you. You know, you start to feel really bad and you're
right. Something ruined my day. It was that exchange. Yeah,
exactly. And it's scary, you know, even though you know that these are probably trolls and that nothing's going to happen, you know, when somebody threatens to kill you on Twitter, you still feel like you're vulnerable as a person. And I think when you grew up, when we did, you always feel a little bit like people don't want you in the world. You know, like, I mean, everyone watched while our community died. There's always a part of you that's like, oh my God, like there's all these people out there who just would rather I was gone, you know? And that's so I think on an emotional, there's like the business level, which is bad because it affects your sales and your ability to get out there as an author. And then there's the emotional level. On the emotional level, I will say I've gotten much better. I've kind of learned to ignore and stay true to my values. I think the hardest thing, and I think if, you know, you read like A Love Story and you started Only This Beautiful Moment, like, you know, that I think my books are genuinely about trying to create connection, empathy. Like, I can't let book banners turn me into somebody who's coming from a place of anger and resentment. Like, I have to, my job is to stay centered both for my children as a parent and for my work as a writer so that I can be coming from a place of hope and love. Cause what's the point of creating if you're not trying to inspire people, you know?
And that comes through in your book. And I was listening to it going, he's not trying to groom people around sexuality or anything like that, but he is trying to instill a kind of emotional intelligence, a kind of open-heartedness. There is an emotional connectedness that you are proselytizing for, I think, you know?
Look, like my new book, so my newest book is called Only This Beautiful Moment, and it's the story of three men in the same Iranian family. So it takes place in the 30s, the 70s, and present day. And two of the characters are gay, the grandfather in the 30s and the youngest grandson in the present day. And the middle generation is somebody who's very much of my father's generation, and he is a passionate, loving human with lots of colors to him, but he's also homophobic and not that enlightened when it comes to queer issues. Yeah. And, you know, I've talked to some readers who read that character and who can't really forgive that character. And then I talk to readers who understand what I'm trying to do, which is to say that, yes, that character has this flaw, but he also has so much grief and loss and love and passion. And it's one of the most important stories I've ever told and the one I'm proudest of, because it's very much my journey with my father and his generation of Iranian men. You know, I come from a homophobic culture and I love them.
Yeah.
You know, people like Americans are always, so much of that book is about like my relationship to a lot of the Western world, where they're always like, you shouldn't talk to your parents if they like they're homophobic, or you shouldn't go visit your aunt and uncle if they voted for Trump or whatever. And I'm like, well, you know what? Like, when you're an immigrant and you like move to four countries with your family and they're all you got, like, it's not that easy to shut the door on. Like, and the truth is, like, my dad and his generation came a long way. Like, are they, you know, waving pride flags at parades? No. But do they love and accept me? And are they a vibrant, like, part of my life? Yes. Like, and so I don't know. I feel like our world is in a truly divided place right now. And so much of what I believe is that we have to heal wounds wherever we can. We can't just like sit in anger and resentment and hate people. Like, what's going to come from that?
Nothing. Right. There's a character in the book who is a young gay man and a podcaster. And he's very up to speed on everything that's problematic, everything that's, and he's like one of those scolds that we have so many of. And they're not wrong, but they are insufferable. And they are unforgiving. And they are ungracious, I think. I'm generalizing, but I was like, that's what you were getting at. One of your protagonists is the boyfriend of the protagonist, Shane, is this podcaster guy, and your Iranian protagonist is trying to navigate this relationship with a guy who sees everything as black and white, but also he is a family that's accepting of him. Like he has the luxury of being able to be one of those kind of every position's right, every. And that pop star is culturally appropriating, and they shouldn't be doing that. And like, it's that whole thing. And they're not wrong, like I said, but boy.
I think sometimes they are wrong.
Right.
I think it's very easy. I mean, that book begins when Mood, who is the present day teenager, is gay, is going to go to Iran to see his grandfather who's dying. And his boyfriend, Shane, who's very much of this social media warrior figure, is incensed because in Iran they, you know, execute people for being gay. And he's like, how could you go to this country, you know, where they kill gay people? And as part of his preparation for going, Mood is like deleting his social media because he doesn't want to be, you know, publicly
gay. Because it's literally life and death.
And I think there is, you know, for me as an Iranian person, I feel like I've always had this divide between the gay community that I belong to and the Iranian community. The values are so different, and there's very little understanding on either side. But, you know, I think for an American who has the privilege of having liberal, open-minded parents who accept him from day one, to tell an Iranian how they should feel about their culture is wrong.
Yeah.
I'm not scared to say that anymore, because for so long I covered that up. I was like, you know, but it's, you know, I don't need people who are not of my culture to judge the culture. I need them to ask me what the culture is like. And I think part of what is so beautiful about this book, and it's very well researched, I have family that still lives in Iran, I have friends who live there, is I get to show what being queer there does look like. The truth is there are gay people in Iran, you know?
Party scene early on in your book, and it's so... I love to travel because I love to see how other people live. And I realized reading your books, I know nothing about Iran, nothing. Yeah. I know that it's, you know, kind of where it is in the world. I know that, you know, we're not allies. And I know that they are, you know, the leader said there's no gay people in our country. But I really know nothing about it. What the industries are or what it's like at all. So it was really an interesting window for me just to learn a little bit more about that world. When did you leave? You were born there, right?
I was born there. I left when I was two, and I've never been back.
And you've never been back?
I have never been back. I don't think I ever will. I mean, there is always the hope that maybe the regime falls and there's a new government that is more accepting. But I think as the years pass, I lose more and more hope because the region just feels like it's getting worse, not better.
I know. It's very sad.
It's very sad. I mean, I've always wanted to go back. I wish I had gone back when I was younger, to be honest, but it would have been very hard. It would have, you know, with my family, it would have been hard. But I have many cousins who go back and forth. I have cousins who grew up there who I'm very close with. I have an uncle who moved back there. You know, and that scene, that party scene that you referred to, so Mood goes to Iran in the book, and he meets his cousin Ava, who he's never met before, and she's very
fabulous.
Fabulous. And she's very inspired by my cousin who lived in Iran for most of her life, who, if you met her, you would be obsessed with her. She's just brash and big and such a huge queer ally, like that my cousin was like so loud about her acceptance of me when I came out, you know. And Ava takes him. She doesn't know, or no, she does from Instagram know he's gay, but he hasn't come out to her. And she takes him to a party. And a lot of people at the party are queer, and it's not at all what he expected. It's this like group of artists. And it's very much inspired by when an American friend of mine went to Tehran. A lot of Western people do visit Tehran. Usually you have to visit on some kind of cultural visa tour. And he was in Dubai doing a Fulbright, and he went to Tehran, and he was going to be on this tour group. And I said to him, no, my cousin's going to pick you up. Like, you got to see the real Tehran. And I get this phone call from him at like 4 a.m. Tehran time. And he's like, I don't even know what's happening. I'm at a party in Tehran. Everybody's gay. Everybody's high. Like, everybody's
fabulous. What's happening? Yeah.
What is this? Because you think Tehran and you think like repression and, you know, fear. And I'm like, well, that's Tehran. Like, nobody understands that what you see, it's this very different thing. In America, we think so much in terms of like visibility, coming out, what we post, how we present ourselves. And in Tehran, you don't have the luxury of presenting yourself, honestly. That's not what you have. So what you do is you get together in private residences and you have this vibrant life. You do have a queer life. You just don't have the luxury of being out the way we are, or writing books the way we are. And in a way, I felt like when I was writing Only This Beautiful Moment in particular, because it's so Iranian, like, I felt this real sense of responsibility to finally write Iranian characters who weren't Western, who weren't growing up in LA or New York. They were actually living in Iran and still finding ways to connect. And it's just a reminder that as a queer community, as a gay community, whatever you want to call it, like, we have to start thinking more globally. Like, what, it's not just about us here in the West. There are so many other countries, and how is it for them? And what do they actually need? Not what we think is right for them, but what do they need?
There's also little cultural touches that show up in the book that I find charming. Like, there's a tradition or a word in Iran for when you're trying to fight over who pays the check at a restaurant.
Yeah.
What is it?
Parof.
And what is that? That is the act of trying to pay for the check.
Well, it's not really about paying for the check. It's more about, oh God, it's untranslatable. We talk about this.
But I love these little, these little windows into a different culture.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, within the Iranian community, we often talk about stuff like that, like words that we can't find translations for, or expressions that when you do translate them sound so ridiculous, but they speak so much to the culture, you know, to the norms. And, you know, I am very, like, I feel like so many immigrant kids, I'm very much like this weird hybrid where I have like a lot of the West in me. Like, I have a lot of, like, I believe in, you know, creating myself and in, you know, like that. When I think of the West, I think mostly of individualism. I think of like, you create yourself, you get to choose your destiny. Right. When I think of Iranian culture and Eastern culture, it's often around like family loyalty trumping anything. You really belonging to a collective is almost more important. And I really believe in a little bit of both. Like, I think as much as like I want to hopefully see a liberated Iran and to see countries like it, you know, have much better laws, my God, I also think like people here who have the privilege of actually reading everything and having open knowledge, like, should learn a little bit too, because when I look around America, I see people who are craving community, craving family loyalty, craving the kinds of bonds that Iranians, you know, get to take granted. Like, I didn't, you know, my parents were not that accepting when I came out, but they also never turned their back on me. There was never any question that I wouldn't always be welcome in their home and that I would always love them too. There was an understanding that no matter what, family sticks together.
They weren't going to throw you out on the street no matter what. That is not a thing.
Never. Yeah. Never. It wouldn't even be like, that does not happen in our culture. It is like, I don't know an example of it. You stick by your people.
Yeah.
And I don't see Americans doing that. I see Americans throwing their kids out onto the street too often. I'm like, how could you, what is that? Like, what kind of social fabric can we expect? And so I just think we need the kind of cross-cultural learning that would hopefully benefit all.
Is this book available in Iran?
Well, not that I know of. That's a big question. We can't have, you know, of course, you know, in Iran, you can't have most books, let alone books. I mean, it would be illegal. But what happens in Iran that I'm aware of, and I've gotten, you know, once I got an email from someone asking if they could translate one of my books, I think it was like a love story. I can't remember. And I forwarded on to my agents because the agents have, like, they deal with there's a foreign rights department. And the agents basically said, you're not legally allowed to sell your book to Iran. You can't do business with Iran. What you could tell the person is, like, if you decide to translate it, like, I'm not going to stop you, you know?
Right, I'm not going to sue you.
Yeah, I know people in Iran have read some of my books because I've gotten, you know, notes and stuff. But I don't know how. I think there's, from what I understand, Iran, there's a lot of people like send PDFs around and, you know, there's a lot of like black market stuff. I mean, one of my favorite stories that my cousins would always tell me about Iran is there's these guys that come around like houses when they're having parties and they'll sell everything from like booze to CDs to like Jennifer Lopez CDs, like whatever. Yeah. You know, they're not actual CDs, you know, they're not like being scanned, yeah. All like, you know, bootleg stuff. They'll have like hidden satellites to watch TV. They're resourceful people.
Yeah. I host these virtual game nights as a side hustle. You could see the sign behind me, You Don't Know My Life. And they're based on questions that I developed as an interviewer, and it's a box game and a whole thing. And one time we had a game and there was a gentleman playing from Iran. I don't know where he was based now, somewhere in Europe. We get people from all over the world. And the question was, what was something you bought as a reward to yourself? And he told this story about buying these like black market basketball shoes, like Michael Jordan, Air, whatever. And, you know, it's like, well, how did you get the money? And he goes, well, I used to sell on the black market Britney Spears CDs and NSYNC CDs. And it was just this window into this world. And there was a sort of like pride of resourcefulness and that the workaround and like that. And it was just, it's one of the reasons I love to host those games, because you get these windows into these stories from people from all over the world. But it was sort of human beings finding a workaround to try to be themselves or try to find their things. And I think that comes through in your book as well.
And I want to add, because you were asking, like, at one point you said, I don't know what people in Iran do or something like that.
I really know nothing about Iran.
So one thing that I think is very – and I'm not going to give you an exact statistic because I don't want to get it wrong. But one thing I think people should know about Iran is it's one of the youngest countries around. It has a remarkably young population. And when people say, like, the government doesn't represent the people, I think Iran is a classic example of that. The government truly does not represent the people of Iran. I mean, the people of Iran have been in the streets protesting for over a year now since the death of Mahsa Amini. And it's just one of many protest movements that's popped up. And, of course, the government puts protesters in prison, killed them, you know.
Well, there's truly, protest scenes in your book awful. From generations ago. And
that's right. And it's been going on and on. It's an endless cycle. And, you know, but I say that to say that, like, the people of Iran are so not the government. They're mostly young. Iran has all these young entrepreneurs. It has, I think, the character of Ava in Only This Beautiful Moment, if memory serves, works at, like, a streamer, like a music streamer. You know, there was a great article a while ago about how Iran has had this tech boom of entrepreneurs. They have their versions of like Uber and this and that. You know, it's a young population and it's a very educated population. That's the other thing. Iran has a very, very high rate of education. It's a country that if the people were just given the freedom to be themselves, I think that country would surprise everybody. I think the people of Iran are so smart, so resourceful, so passionate, so willing to fight for their rights, for who they are. They just happen to live in one of the most repressive regimes, and the rest of the world has left them to rot. I mean, really sad. It's really, really sad.
It must be hard and kind of frustrating to be writing about this place that you can't go, like, that this can, you feel this connection to, but from a remove. Like, can you talk about how that feels? Because obviously you did a lot of research and you're talking to people all the time. But you're also in London or you're in California. I don't know. I just feel like this book is so much about that place.
It is. I mean, it's a longing. That's the only word I can
feel
think of. It's the longing, and it's a longing I share with so many immigrants who come from places that either they can't go back to for their safety or places that just don't even look the same. I mean, you think about Iran, like, the Iran that my parents left is not the Iran that's there now. I mean, they renamed all the streets after the revolution. They changed everything. It's not even the same place necessarily. I mean, the country doesn't even have the same name as it did then. You know, the Iran that exists now is different from the one of my parents and probably different than the one that'll exist when I'm much older. I don't know if I'll ever see it. It, you know, it was always my dream that I could maybe, if the regime fell, go back with my family and have them tell me the stories. I mean, You know, when I think about my book, I write a lot of historical fiction. And I think a lot of that is because when I was growing up, my history was a void. Like my parents, like many immigrants, thought that the right way to shield us from, I think, the trauma, truly, it's not a word they would ever use, but I'll use it, the trauma of what they went through leaving that country, was to not tell us about it because they wanted us to have this fresh start, yeah. You know? And then you think about queer history, it was not available to me. And so I felt like when I was finally coming into myself as an adult, I'm like, well, who am I? How do I even know who I am when I don't know who preceded me? And I really believe young people need to kind of see themselves in history. And so I long to go back there and have my parents tell me, like, show me where they had their formative years, their experiences, where I was born, where I spent the first years of my life. I mean, I have relatives I've never met. You know, I have an aunt I've never met. I have cousins I've never met.
Yeah.
And for somebody who cares about family so much, I mean, my family is really everything to me. It's just so, it's very sad. And I guess that comes through in the writing. But, you know, I was so moved that so many of my family members wanted to talk to me about it for this book, because I couldn't have written this book without them. I needed people who lived in Iran now to tell me about the present. And I needed, you know, one of my aunts in particular talked to me for hours and hours about Iran in the 70s. Because you can go and, you know.
Well, the key club or the dance clubs were the.
Exactly.
Like, it sounded kind of fabulous.
Oh, it was. Oh, Iran in the 70s was fabulous.
Yeah.
I mean, my God, like everybody was there. Elizabeth Taylor would visit and Bob, mom's like, oh, yeah, I saw Bob Dylan in Iran. Yeah. And this, you know, Warhol would visit. But, you know, the thing is you can't go to a library or even go to Google with all this wealth of information on the internet. You can't go and research gay life in Iran. And you can't research all that much about like what was happening socially in Iran in the 70s. You can find a lot of information about the politics, you know, about the revolution and about like modern day nuclear deals and stuff. But like the other stuff was always kind of hidden. And so it was the research process where it was very different. It's not like ACT UP where you can go to a library and find a million articles about every single action. You have to find people who are living it or who did live it. And that felt very special to me in writing Only This Beautiful Moment.
What are you observing about young people reading this book who aren't immigrants, just a white bread American kid?
The book, I feel like it's been a bit of a slow burn. You know what's really fun? And I apologize for my dog who is like growling. Background.
I didn't notice. Yeah.
One fun story I was going to tell you about Only This Beautiful Moment is that party where we first met, where I was wearing the Madonna t-shirt.
Yes.
And it was a party of gay writers. While I was at that party, I got a message from a librarian to call them back. And that is when I found out that Only This Beautiful Moment won the Stonewall Award for this year, which was a really big in the young adult community. It's a very, very big award. So that Like a Love Story was one of the honor books, but it didn't win. And Only This Beautiful Moment won. And I found out right when I met you.
So I love that. Is there a ceremony?
There is. I'm going to go in. I don't know exactly when it is. Late June, early July in San Diego this year. It's the American Library Association conference. But so I think more people are reading it now because of that is why.
Yeah, it helps.
I think young people, it's hard for me to say like white bread, because for the most part, when I go visit classrooms these days, it's so diverse. Like it's very rare that I visit a classroom of all white kids.
I think it's a great example. And the more specific something is, the more universal it is, the more real something feels. It feels like you just said, oh, I'm just going to tell the truth about all this stuff in my life with both books. And
absolutely.
And people are being drawn to it.
Yeah. And look, I think like with this book, sometimes people will, you know, young people will be really interested in Iranian culture and ask me more questions that are geared toward that. But sometimes it's not even about that. Sometimes it's about like, this book made me realize I haven't asked my parents a lot of questions about their own lives. Like that was to me, Only This Beautiful Moment is about the biggest revelation I think I had in my growing up years, which was I craved a kind of love and understanding from my parents and their generation when I was young that I felt I didn't get. And when I became old enough to be more empathetic, I realized I never showed them the curiosity I wanted.
Right.
I never asked them a thing.
That's a sentiment that comes out in the book, because you talk about this thing being very Iranian of we don't talk about stuff. We just bury right. Everything's fine. And I think a lot of cultures relate to that. But at one point, your character's like, I'm going to try to break that. I'm going to set that's out what, to actively break that. And I feel like that's what you're doing in the books.
Yeah. And that's what I did in my life. And that's what I do in the books. Yeah. And that's what I try to teach my kids to do. And it's very normal. Like, we go about our lives, right? And like, yeah. Life seems to just happen. And then there's a point at which I think if you really want to be a person who lives with intention, which to me is what a creative person is, to be creative to me is just living with intention, yes. Instead of letting life happen to you, that you decide like, you know what, if I want this from this person, I'm going to have to exhibit that behavior and ask them a little bit and express curiosity about them and then see if it comes back. And then miracles happen. You yes. Discovery happen and connection happens.
Yeah. The book is about three generations, three different people. The middle generation is LA in like the 70s, 80s. There's the piano bar, the other side. There are scenes, which sadly is no longer there, but thank you for getting it captured on your pages. Talk about the other side.
Well, I never went to the other side.
You never went? I only went a handful of times, but it was a piano bar in Silver Lake.
When did it close? I mean, I knew.
I think it closed not that long ago, within the last 10 years. Yeah, I think.
I wonder if I did go.
Yeah, I mean, I was on Hyperion.
I remember where it was. Yeah. I don't think I went. I moved here in 98. Yeah. Don't know if I went, but I always knew of the other side. And yeah. I love history. And the things I love about history aren't the things that made the headlines. Yeah. I love things like this gay bar was on that corner. And, you know, this is where it's those kinds of things that I try and populate into the books. Like, you know, one of my favorite scenes of the book is in the 30s when there's a party at Billy Haynes's house, who was Joan Crawford's best friend. It was yeah. This like out actor who, you know, Louis B. Mayer fired because he refused to be in a relationship with a woman and then became an interior decorator. And just this piece of old Hollywood that I feel like hasn't gotten the attention it should.
Yeah.
Or like this gay bar that's forgotten where people were singing. And I just had this vision in that scene. It's Saeed, who's the 1970s character, and he is there with the woman who will become his wife, and it's a piano bar and the gays are singing, like, I can't remember what songs.
I Can't Say No is one of them. They're like doing yes, this, like,
isn't there a chorus
what I
line?
Did for love, which I thought yes. Tied in the idea of, like, I found that very poignant. I may have cried.
Because I'm obsessed with a chorus line. I feel like I put a chorus line into so many of my books.
Well, that song gets more meaningful as you get older because you realize like what it means to pursue your dream and as an artist. And they sing a song in Iranian in the piano bar. And I could picture it.
One of my favorite songs. Yeah, it's a Gugush. Gugush is like our biggest diva. She's like our Madonna or Cher or whatever you want. And Do Panjere is one of her biggest songs. And it's a very slow, it's a ballad, but it's just so beautiful because the song is about these two windows. Do Panjere means two windows. It's about these two windows that want to be together, but they're separated, of course, because there's a wall around them.
Right.
And the only way for them to be together is for the whole thing to crash. And to me, so much of the book is about uniting things that don't feel like they can be united, whether it's West and East or whether it's gay and straight or whether, you know, it's about like, how do we take these two things, these two windows that everyone says can't be united and find a way to unite them.
Yeah.
And I just like, I had this vision of that song and at a gay piano bar. It all felt very exciting when I came up with it.
Well, I was moved by it. It painted a picture and I'd been there and I love the idea that these two immigrants were singing this song in another language. They just sort of took over the place and transported it to a different world in a moment that was beautiful. And then the character goes back the next day because he leaves his coat and there's literally anal happening in the bathroom stall. And I was like, oh, this is a new level. but you talk about open relationships and you're like, wow, of all the things I read in your books so far, that was the thing I was the most surprised you got away with in terms of a YA situation.
There you go. And a book with discussions of open relationships and anal in a gay bar won the Stonewall Award from the American Library Association. Take that.
But it also opened this idea of not all relationships. Like, if I had understood that when I was younger, it might have liberated me a little bit. Like, I held on to a lot of stuff that I don't think I really believe in my heart for a long time.
I was raised on movies. I was raised on romantic comedies. I was raised on, like, ideas of monogamy that I thought, you know, were important.
Right.
And I genuinely wish people had talked to me about what gay relationships were, you know, what options were. And I think honestly, now that I am an older gay person who's married with kids and love my life, I have so many heterosexual friends who often turn to me being like, wait, how does your, tell us about how you guys do it. Because the even the vast majority of straight people I know these days are like moving past that. It's, there's a lot of concepts that, you know, but are part of that we, for whatever reason, are not comfortable talking about. And I think we just have to move past some of that discomfort and find the right ways. And this is why I love writing fiction and not, I never want to write a memoir or something about my life. It's not who I am. But to me, fiction just feels like a much safer way to broach certain topics because you're talking about characters and it allows you to think about them with a remove of like, I'm not judging a human here. Let's talk about this character. Like, what do we think?
Well, you know? I think you're very good at it. You're very good at planning these ideas that open somebody's mind up while making it feel like it's couched in a character. You feel like they would say that. You're not like, oh, he's pushing a message here. But it does sort of like, oh, he's interesting. He's introducing the idea of like some people have sex outside of the relationships in the bathroom stalls. And guess what? It's not the end of the world. It's not a bad thing. I grew up thinking slutty people were worse.
And by the way, it doesn't mean that they don't love the person they go home to.
Right. And you find a way to get that in there. And what are your interactions with young people? Because when I talk to young people, sometimes I have more hope for the future because I think this world is in a really precarious place. I'm asking for hope, basically.
100%. And people ask me all the time, what gives me hope? It seems to be people's favorite question. It's always the same answer, which is young people. Like, my kids give me hope. Their friends give me hope. The high school classrooms I visit give me hope. I laugh so much. I mean, yesterday I had a Zoom with New York City. The last high school I visited in person was the Chicago one, which is when Madonna was there. And it was so special. Like, the interactions that you have with young people, their curiosity about who you are, like, their questions. It's funny. I always begin each session with young people with the librarian or English teacher who booked me telling me like, these kids are really shy. They probably won't ask you any questions. And then like all the hands go up and there's a million questions. And it's in one. And so one of the guy who headed up the English department at the Chicago school I was at said that he's like, what you did with these kids is you didn't talk at them. You talked with them. And I think that's part of it is, you know, for young people to give you hope, you have to let them know you respect them. You know, you have to let them know that their point of view matters to you, that you're not just there to tell them how it is. They know how it is for them. They know their experience. What you're doing is presenting yourself honestly in hopes that they'll do the same and there'll be a cross-generational exchange that is special, you know, and that will open up their minds, but also open up yours. I've learned so much from young people. And I think the problem with a lot of older people, honestly, I'm much more worried about older people. I'm more worried about my generation than I am about young people. I worry, even my good friends, older people lose their curiosity. And to me, curiosity is the number one thing. And I'm pretty sure I can't point to the interview that Madonna said the same thing. It's actually one of the biggest things Madonna taught me was curiosity, because she's such a student, right? She watches films from every country and reads voraciously and like is constantly like ingesting art from around the world. Like,
and we always kind of know her phase. Oh, this is her Frida Kahlo phase. This is her Kabbalah phase. And it used to feel kind of gimmicky and we'd make fun of it. And now I look back and go, wow, she knows a lot about a lot of things.
I think it was Guy Osiri who said that when he started working for her, she gave him basically a syllabus of like films and books and things he had to know about in order to work for her. And I'm like, that is so cool.
Yeah.
But my worry about older people is like, I hear so much fear around what's happening with young people that doesn't reflect what's really happening. Like when you go into these schools, there's joy, there's hope, there's curiosity, there's laughter, there's angst. There's all the same stuff that was there when we were young. You know, it's just being young. But somehow I feel like older people lose the ability to take it all in with curiosity and openness. There's just a lot of judgment of like how bad things are. But actually, I don't think things are so bad.
What surprised you about the young people? How are they different than we were?
Well, they're, for one thing, much more accepting of all colors of LGBTQ rainbow. I mean, my God, there's queer kids at different, you know, I mean, I can't speak for all schools. I know there are many places in the US and certainly around the world, but, you know, at so many schools, there's kids are coming out much earlier. There's kids who are gay, lesbian, bi, trans, non-binary. Nobody cares. Nobody, like, kids aren't freaking out about it. Like, it's not that big a deal. You know, I think that's huge. That's like a massive change. There's a lot more, I don't know, just a lot more like acceptance around that stuff. I mean, which is not to say, like, of course, young people are still young. They're still going to be mean sometimes and be bullies sometimes, because that's just developmentally appropriate for what kids go through. But, you know, I think that that has changed a lot. I think a lot of young people, and this is something that's really interesting for me, because I think there, it is a double-edged sword, but they're much more self-possessed in the ability they have to like stand up for who they are, what they believe in, talk to an adult like an equal. You know, when I was young, I was very much raised to like sit quietly in the kids' table, you know? And I do think that there is an importance. I do think some young, not all, but some young people also need to be taught like how to respect people while disagreeing. You know, there are like certain social skills around how you talk, especially to elders, that I would, you know, that are important, like in the Iranian community, that I sometimes talk to my kids about. But I love how they're able to stand up for their beliefs in a way that feels very different than when I was young.
Is there a part of you that is kind of surprised that part of your job now is going to talk to kids in schools?
Oh, if you had told me that when I was, I mean, when we were growing up, the idea of gay people in schools was still shocking. You know, right. You couldn't, gay teachers was like a, you know, I remember, and it's funny because I always wanted kids and I didn't think I would have them. And like, what a miracle that I have two 12-year-olds now. But I remember when I moved to LA wanting to volunteer for Big Brothers Big Sisters, which I didn't do. I ended up volunteering for APLA. But I remember thinking like, should I not do this? Like, are people, I don't want to like volunteer for Big Brothers and be a Big Brother someone and they find out I'm gay and the family doesn't want, like the idea of, you know, someone from our community around kids was still somehow shocking. So now the fact that I'm going to schools to like talk to young people.
Right. You're the guest of honor. You're the, like the big thing. What have you observed about the librarians and the teachers? Do they feel kind of like they're in a culture war, or how are they?
They're the real heroes, to be honest. Like when people ask me about book banning, I often feel like the authors get too much attention and the librarians and teachers get none. They're the ones who are on the front lines. You know, I've talked to librarians who they can't get queer books approved, you know, in terms of their budgets anymore. So, but they have queer students, so they buy it out of their own pocket a lot.
Wow.
That's a very thing. A lot of librarians are being, you know, they're offering safe spaces. A lot of the librarians I talk about how it's not the privileged popular kids who love libraries. It's the marginalized kids. It's the queer kids. It's the one who don't have other safe spaces. Like the library is their safe space, you know? So to me, they're real heroes. And I mean, are they in a culture war? Like, yes, I think undoubtedly they are, but I don't think that's the vibe you get when you're with them. When you're with them, you just get the vibe that they care about their community and their kids, and that they are doing everything they can to create these beautiful environments where kids can be together, read, study, laugh. Like, it's really, I love it. Like, I mean, honestly, when you go into a high school and you walk in the library and you see all these kids clustered together, and some of them are reading and some of them are just gossiping and some of them are doing homework, and it's, nothing is as hopeful as young people who are preparing themselves to take on the world. And I hope this generation, I really do think this next generation is going to do some amazing stuff, because the world is in shambles.
It really is. It really is.
It's really in shambles.
Yeah.
And that's, a lot of it is our generation's fault and the one before us. And these kids are smart. They're really smart. You know, I just hope that the world lets them lead.
Yeah.
You know, because I think older people are not very good at ceding power. I want to see more young people like taking over.
Yeah.
It's our time to like sit still soon.
Right. No, for sure. I get that. And I'm really glad I didn't have social media when I was growing up. I think it would have been a real challenge. You write about that at the beginning of Only This Beautiful Moment, like Mood's attitude around social media. Can you remember, can you read a little bit of that? Or do you remember kind of the sentiment of
yeah.
it? Because when I read it, I thought, oh yes, this needs to be said.
Okay, so this is Mood. I'll read a very short piece. This is Mood, and he's basically telling his boyfriend Shane that before going back to Iran, he's going to wipe his social media because there's all this, you know, pictures of them together, gay things that will clearly give away that he's gay that he doesn't want there before going to a country where it's illegal to be gay. So, okay. I should tell him about wiping my feed. I should say something because if there's one thing about me that annoys him, it's that I sometimes expect him to read my mind because I'm no good at putting my feelings into words, but I can't. Not when I'm staring at the Harvey Milk poster on his wall, the one with the words, every gay person must come out on it. How do I tell my boyfriend, who believes that every queer person must be loud and proud, that I just went a little bit back in? And how do I tell my boyfriend, who expresses his every opinion online, that I already feel liberated by my online absence? That it feels good not to feel the pressure to engage in every debate and every meme, that I don't want to post another photo of a pop star and label it gay rights, that I never really cared about Stan Wars or mac and cheese recipes or who was mom or who snatched our wigs or who centered what or who platformed what or what went viral or who always understood the assignment or who never understood the assignment, especially because when it comes to social media, the person who never understood the assignment was me. I never understood why I needed to document my dull life. People love to begin by saying, I don't know who needs to hear this, but, and the thing is, usually no one needs to hear it.
Yes, that's it. When everyone's like, I don't know. It's an audio thing, but I always want somebody to say, I don't know who needs to hear this, and then fart. Because that's right. My sense of humor.
That's really funny.
Yeah. But it also feels like... Are we ever going to care about that stuff? That stuff isn't, it's a lot of effort to put into something that's not going to live, yeah. Right?
But you know, yes, well, I'll give you, yesterday I did a Zoom with a classroom in New York City, like I've mentioned, and the usually what happens when I visit these classes is there's a little bit piece where I give a speech and then they ask questions. And it's always the best part is where the kids ask questions. And they asked me a lot of questions about social media. They were asking me about my opinions about it, about activism on social media. They had read Like a Love Story as part of their group. So, you know, we had a really engaging discussion. And to my surprise, a lot of the young people were just as interested in debating the pros and cons of social media as we are from our generation.
They're trying to make sense of it too.
Right. And so, you know, I began by saying, look, like I find that I'm a very young at heart person. I'm very curious. I still engage with the arts, with what young people are reading, listening to, all of that. The one place where I sound old is social media, because I do have like a lot of opinions about why it's not good. But, you know, I was telling them that in my opinion, and again, it's an opinion, and some of the students gave me counterpoints, but in my opinion, I see too many people on social media who are under the illusion that they're creating change by posting something, but really they're stopping themselves from taking actions that would actually create sustainable change. And, you know, looking at something like ACT UP as a model, like ACT UP put so much thought into each action, so much planning, because they wanted them to be truly effective. They weren't there to like scream into a void. They existed to lower drug prices, to include women and people of color in medical trials, to change the FDA process of approving drugs. Like they had tangible goals. And so what I was telling these young people is like, if you want to be an activist and all you do is post, then you have to ask yourself, what's the tangible?
What's the next thing?
Yeah. But also, like, has it created change? Like, if me and all my friends are posting about something we want to see in the world and that thing isn't coming, are our posts effective? Because at the end of the day, that's what it is. What I love about ACT UP isn't just what they did. It's that they actually achieved their goals. It's stunning what they did when you think about it. Like, they changed United States drug policies, like medical trial policies. I mean, it affected how quickly we got COVID vaccines. Like they changed the world. So, I mean, I think when I think about social media, it comes down to like, if you're going on social media, be like, here's my vacation or buy my book, whatever. But if you want to create change in the world, you have to be tracking what's working and what's not. And if there are places where social media has been effective, that's great. In my opinion, you know, I don't think there would have been Trump without social media. I don't think we would see a rise in fascism all over Europe without social media. I don't, you know, social media, while it's given people the illusion of activism, it's also given us massive misinformation, the ability, you know, it's as with many things, you know, we had some utopian vision of the internet, but it's controlled by a bunch of, you know, not great people who, you know, care
put,
more about
put
their
profits over, over the well-being of the commonwealth.
Yeah, profits over people. So, you know, these are all important things to debate. I only wanted to bring up that classroom visit yesterday because I think young people are having the same debate. They're just curious as we are, and they're just as concerned about it. And I actually think the next generation is going to give up using social media the way we did.
I could see it being like, okay, we did that. Yeah. And like maybe like
exactly.
superhero
movies. I
think
the era of everyone feeling the need to post everything they did online is gone. Yeah. It's over.
And yet I do find myself scrolling and being like, Dennis, stop it. Put it down. I don't post a ton, but I do get, I can get sucked into that dopamine hit of like.
Well, I can too. Of course. And I do it less and less, but yeah, of course. And then there's things like the Madonna thing. Like, of course I want to see like who her guest was last night at the
Exactly. Game. All and of that stuff. In, who was you your know? Guest when you saw her?
Tizo Touchdown.
Yeah.
Not the most exciting. I wanted like someone great.
I know. You know? And ours was Eric Andre, a comedian, and I, you know, I wanted Britney Spears or somebody. But I mentioned earlier in the beginning of our conversation, you've produced and written in Hollywood, and one of your credits is Call Me By Your Name, which is a movie that I love. What was your role in that?
I'm an associate producer on that, which is still really cool and impressive. Yeah. And I, you know, anyone who's worked in Hollywood knows that it's not the highest producer credit.
Right.
In fact, I think it might be the lowest. But I, for 6 years, when I had kids and it was post the 2007-2008 writer's strike, I went into panic mode about being a writer and went and got an MBA. So I have an MBA, which is absolutely wild to me. And after getting an MBA, amazing.
What's it in?
Just a master's in business. I know spreadsheets. I know finance.
I'm looking for ideas is why I'm asking. Yeah.
Well, you know, honestly, it was a fear-based thing, but it ended up being the best thing for me because pre-MBA, I was, as many artists are, I was very passive. I was kind of waiting for studios to tell me what to write and hire me. And post-MBA, I did two things. One was write books, which changed my life. And the second was I had met with an amazing company called Water's End, and I kind of pitched myself not as a writer, but as somebody who could head up development for them because at that point I'd made so many contacts in the industry. I understood both business and storytelling, and I worked there for 6 years, and it was one of the best jobs I've ever had in my life. I got to support, you know, filmmakers and artists with financing. And so Call Me By Your Name was one such film where Water's End, I believe, I don't want to speak out of turn, might have been the first company to put money in that helped the primary producer secure the rights and start the whole development process to that movie. So as the head of development of the company at the time, I got to be involved in the scripts and reading stuff, you know, and again, I don't want to overstate my involvement, which was pretty minuscule. But
you never
was
handled the peach, for example. You weren't there.
No.
In the you weren't in the fountain.
I could have gone to set and I didn't because at the time, well, first of all, at the time we were making so many movies at the company and it was shooting in a remote part of Italy. And it was like, why am I going to go? Once I saw the film, I really kicked myself for not being, you know, there, but it was still so special. I mean, just to be, you know, I think like me, you know, we came from just about the same generation and we talked about coming from a time where making queer and gay content in Hollywood seemed so hard and so unheard of and miraculous when it happened. And I remember so viscerally that first screening of Call Me By Your Name at Sundance, which I was at, and thinking this will be just another gay indie movie everyone forgets about, like so many others. And the standing ovation it got and the tears. And the, I mean, I remember looking around that room and thinking, holy shit, like this movie is going to do something. It's going to affect people. It's going to reach people.
Right.
You know?
It's going to cross over from the festival circuit.
And that's what you want as an artist. Like I've really had very few experience. I mean, Like a Love Story is another one. That book has really reached people somehow, but as an artist, you just want your work to reach people somehow because you put so much heart into it. And I know that movie is not my heart and soul because I wasn't the creator. It's really the writers and Luca Guadagnino, who, in my opinion, is one of the greatest working directors. But, you know, just to have a small piece of involvement in something that great was, it was so moving to me. And then to, I mean, the movie won an Oscar. Like, yeah. I don't even understand. Like, my name comes up in a movie that won an Oscar. It's just, it's a dream.
Right. And also, you got to see something from the beginning when it was just a book. Yeah. And maybe somebody, and then you could see the trajectory.
Right. And a great book. Yeah. And a great book. And it also, like, peripherally, just little things happen because of that. Like, I got to moderate, you know, to me, that book is such a masterpiece and such a, you know, brilliant piece of literature. And I got to moderate this amazingly big event out here with the author, Andre Aciman, which never would have happened had I not been involved in the movie. But, you know, that was just little special moments like that, where you think like, it, you know, you just, I've been doing this along like over two decades now of writing, producing, trying to just be a storyteller in whatever medium they'll let me do it in. And once in a while, magic happens. And when it does, you just have to enjoy it. And that was one of those. Call Me By Your Name is one of those magical films where so few indie movies make it in that way and become classics. And I think that movie is a classic now.
Yeah. How does your writing books compare to your work in Hollywood? In terms of how it feels?
Much more personal. The books really are mine. You know, they feel mine. Like, I feel an ownership over them. I mean, yes, an editor helps me and people give me notes, but it's always, the notes are always at my discretion to deal with. And they're always about uncovering. Like, I feel like a good editor for an author is an editor who helps the author tell their story. In my experience in Hollywood, I've really been aiding other people's stories. Like, if I'm in a writer's room on a TV show, which is something I love to do because it's such a sense of community and camaraderie among writers, but you're really there to tell the showrunner's vision of the story. Oftentimes I get jobs and it's like my job to interpret what the network wants or the studio wants. There are people in Hollywood who get to tell personal stories. I just haven't gotten that experience yet because I don't think Hollywood is ready for these stories. I mean, we've tried, amazing, amazing teams of creative people have tried to make a lot of my books and they haven't succeeded. Yeah. So I don't know that Hollywood's ready for like Iranian gay teen stories.
Well, I think they should be.
They should be, but yeah, how are they going to get them financed? You know how the business works.
Here's my final question. Is there a lesson that people can take from your trajectory where you've kind of bobbed and weaved and where you've ended up?
I think a few things that come up. I mean, one is just true perseverance. Like, as someone who's been doing this a long time, I think it takes a very specific kind of person to be in the creative arts this long. You really have to put your sensitivities aside and be willing to pick yourself up, because you will be, no matter how, even the most successful people I know are rejected constantly in this industry. It's very hard. So learning, building that well of perseverance, and a lot of that is filling your life with really good community. You need friends, partners, family. You need people who are there for you and give you your core so that your career is not your core, you know? About midway through my career, I read a book called The Artist's Way. I don't know if you've ever read it.
Yeah,
or
I've
done
heard
it.
Of it. Yeah.
So to me, that was life-changing. It's really my like creative way of life is in that book. And I return to it every time I have writer's block. I restart The Artist's Way. Honestly, I think the other thing is, I find, especially in Hollywood, everybody, like, you have a meeting in Hollywood and everybody's like, what's your favorite TV show right now? Or like, what are you watching on Netflix? And I'm always like, I'm not that interested in like watching what everyone else, like, I try not to like engage in the same world that everyone else is engaged in, because then you're just gonna, I genuinely believe like there is a creative subconscious within all of us. And if you're having an idea, chances are someone else in the world is having the idea. You see it all the time. Almost right. Every idea that I think is good, inevitably I see someone else doing the same thing. And I'm like, wait,
right.
But it's because we're all like taking the same stuff in. And I think one thing I tell young people all the time is like, you have to be reading, watching, listening voraciously to things that other people aren't. You have to be taking, you have to be traveling, you have to be, so much of being creative is experiencing the world and everything it has to offer in a way that's more than like watching the top 10 shows on Netflix. Like, you have to seek inspiration every single day, you know, from sources that others might not. So often I'm reading really obscure things. Like, I really deep dive into random cultures. Like, I get very, like, I don't know, my books are very popular in Brazil, and I've had this amazing relationship with Brazilian readers, and I'm going for the second time soon. But
I saw on your Instagram you were there not long ago.
Yeah, it was there not long ago. I'm going back for another book festival at the end of April, and I absolutely love it there. And I think Madonna's free giant tour have you heard about this?
No.
Oh, you don't know about this?
No.
You know how Madonna did that really odd commercial for the bank?
And everyone's like,
why is Madonna for the bank? Well, apparently the reason is because on May 4th, Madonna is going to do a free show that the bank is paying for up to like between 1 million and 2 million people are projected to show up. It hasn't been 100% confirmed, but it was written about in Globo, which is the New York Times of Brazil. So at this point, it's feeling like it's happening, and it would be the end of this tour. It would be like on May 4th, she goes out with a bang in Brazil with a free show for all her fans. Anyway, it's happening while I'm in Brazil, which is crazy. I'm not going
to
go.
You have to go.
I am. You want me to be in a crowd of 2 million people in Rio?
Yeah.
No, I'm going to be in Bahia.
Yeah, okay.
In a different part of Brazil. But my point was that like the Brazilian readers, like they saw how the more they were responding to my work, I was like, well, I'm curious about why you're responding to my work. I want to understand your culture because clearly there's things that are communicating here. And I'm now upset. I'm reading two books by Brazilian authors right now. I'm obsessed with their music. I subscribe to Globo Play, which is their like streaming platform, so I can watch their shows. And it's just like, I just love it. I love that I'm like taking in all these amazing works of art from people from a culture that virtually no one else in America I know is like looking into Brazilian culture and what their writers are writing about and what their artists are saying. So, you know, I don't know. I think it just goes back to curiosity. I think that's a big lesson for me. It's like, if you stay curious and you stay resilient, your time will come. And then it'll go again and you'll have a fall. And then you got to get back up and stay curious and resilient. And then your time will come again. And then you'll fall again. And the other thing is you have to enjoy the process. If you don't love if you're doing it for the success, you got to stop because the work itself is so hard.
Yeah. I also feel there's a lesson in your story. When you really told the truth and wrote about what you really wanted to write about rather than what you thought the market wanted, that you found more success. Is that fair to say?
I would say that's 100% fair to say. And it was a shocking revelation to me because from the first decade of my career, not only was I told by others not to write my own truth, but I believed it to be true. And so I didn't push as hard as I should have. And it is an absolutely true thing that when you are honest with the world will sense it. They'll respond to that honesty.
Is there a silver lining that came out of the banning part? Something that you learned or a connection that was made that wouldn't have been made otherwise?
You know what? When the banning was at its worst for me, it was exactly a year ago. And I remember that because it was during the kids' spring break when we were home visiting my family and we're about to go back for the kids' spring break. So it's a year to write when it was at its worst. And I was in a really bad place. Like, it really affected me. I was sad. I was angry. I was defensive with people I loved because a lot of people in my life aren't as vocal about queer rights as I am. And I felt like I wasn't being supported the way I wanted to. And I think for me, the silver lining is that I got through it and that I still love the people I want to love and that I still can create from a place of joy and optimism. And that it is a reminder, as Madonna teaches us, to get up over and over and live your values and don't let other people. And I think this is something so important in the age of social media. Like, don't let other people dictate the conversation you're going to have. You dictate what you want to talk about. I write these books so that I can bring the things I love and I want to talk about into the world. And the book banners don't get to make it about the ban. My books aren't about the fact that they're banned. My books are about what they're about, you know?
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. All right.
Okay.
More content.
Okay.
You're around. You. All right. Thank you so much. Thanks again to Abdi Nazemi, and check out his books, Only This Beautiful Moment, Like a Love Story. There are other books before that. I listened to the audio of the two that I listened to, and they did a wonderful job on that. So if you like audiobooks, That's a great option. All right, so this happened. The Oscars happened, and I had a few friends over. I really enjoyed it. I was into it. The Ryan Gosling of it all, that just delighted me to no end. And I got to interview the Oscar producers a few weeks earlier for ABC Disney. And I brought up the Ryan Gosling thing. I told them I would kick in $10 to a GoFundMe to get him to do it. And they knew that he was doing it already, but they didn't let on. They played it cool. So what a moment. I predict he's going to win an Emmy for musical performance on television at the end of the year. And he's just serving it up. And also, I just read that The Fall Guy, his upcoming movie, premiered at South by Southwest, and people are loving it. And if you listen to my previous episode with Drew Drogi and Glenn Gaylord, that was the movie I was most excited about seeing this year because he has a cool jacket. So there's that. All right, that's enough for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Shout out to Oscar Rosario for mixing the episodes. My theme music is by Mark Danos for Placement Music. We'll catch you next time on Dennis, Anyone. Bye.